It's my absolute pleasure to introduce you all to Catherine McAlpine. Catherine works for AFDO and delivers training under the Disability Loop. So Catherine will present her NDIS opportunities training module. She usually it's a 3-hour long training session, but she's got kindly going to condense it and present to us today. And it talks about conflict of interest issues. So I'm sure this is a fascinating subject for you all this afternoon. So just briefly, an introduction into who Catherine is. Catherine has been active in the disability sector since 2005. In 2007, she was appointed the executive officer of Down Syndrome Victoria. In 2011, she was appointed the CEO of Down Syndrome Australia. Catherine feels very fortunate to be in that position. It combines both professional skills and personal passion. Catherine has 3 sons, and her middle child, Julian, has Down syndrome himself. Catherine now is a manager of Disability Loop program, which is run by the Australian AFDO. The funding for this workshop has been provided by the NDIS Sector Development Funding. It's a series of workshops and it fits the needs of small community organisations such as the ones that everyone comes from here today. We encourage you to really save your thoughts for the discussions that we will be having. So Catherine will talk to you more about her NDIS training, so please everyone warmly welcome Catherine.
Thanks so much, everyone. It's lovely to be back. Always feel that's a positive when you've presented at a group and they invite you back again. So thank you. Just firstly, I'd like to pay my respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which this meeting takes place, and pay respect to elders both past and present. Also, I'd like to pay respect to all of you, advocates. I think it's such an important job. I tell people that I'm an advocate, but my CEO roles have involved systemic advocacy. But I see I get so cross. I sometimes find myself struggling to control my emotions in some of the difficult situations, and I just take my hat off to people who can do that day in, day out. And so thank you very much for having me here and treating me like I'm one of you. Certainly, suspect some of you may have heard this story, but I wonder sometimes whether my kids know what advocacy means. And I know that when my son, who was then my eldest son was 13, and he had to go do swimming sports things, and they were in the change rooms at the swimming centre. There was a couple of young men with Down syndrome came in, and they didn't quite speak the same as everyone else, and one of them maybe was singing. And a couple of kids started imitating them. Well, my son didn't know what advocacy was, but what I can tell you is he looked in his advocacy toolkit, and his toolkit, because he's a 13-year-old boy, didn't have much in it, so he took out his feet and went over and kicked the kid in the shins. And the kid stopped, but was really silly, and dobbed on him. Said to the teacher, "Oh, Lee just kicked me." Now, all kudos to the teacher, because the teacher looked at him and went, "Actually, you don't actually generally go around kicking people. Why did you do that, Lee?" And Lee said, "Well, because," and said so. And then said to me with great satisfaction, so then we had a really nice conversation about being different is okay. And so I thought, good on you, he's learnt to advocate. Unfortunately, he's probably learning from me and he kicks when he should just talk nicely. But we're up and running. Now, today, Melissa said that I was condensing 3 hours of workshop. And actually, trying to condense about 12 hours, because we've actually got four workshops that are 3 hours each. But I've just tried to pick out the highlight things that from our experience so far that are of the greatest interest to advocacy agencies. And I also will talk specifically about conflict of interest, and that discussion about conflict of interest, luckily, is informed by the fact that yesterday I had a meeting with Carolyn Wilkes, who is responsible, heads up the DSS team that's responsible for the NDAP program. And so I was able to put to her a whole series of the conflict of interest type questions that have arisen from an organisational point of view. And so I'll do that. Now, I've been also given the hint that finishing earlier rather than later would be well reviewed. I too have to race off and do the working mother dance. So I'll try and keep it moving, and I'll probably allow a little bit longer for questions than we might have initially anticipated, because I've found so far in the workshops that quite a few questions come up. And I am going to, your biggest criticism of me today is I'm going to sort of rush through a bit, and if we allow a little bit longer for questions, and that means that you can pick me up and talk about some context or more detail that I might have missed in this context. Yes, George. This presentation specifically. The materials from the workshops themselves are still being finished in terms of their accessibility. What we've done is the workshops that we've run so far, we ran them in Melbourne first, so we've just taken a bit of that feedback and done a little bit of polishing, and they've gone to print. But we just have to make all that, they're quite big PDFs, and we have to make sure that they're fully accessible. And because we're busy also booking other workshops, we're just a bit under the pump. So we're still about 2 or 3 weeks away. And then after that, the participant handbooks will be available on the Disability Loop website. So it's just, if anyone, I don't know, I think there might be some people that came to our workshops. I said 2 weeks about 2 weeks ago. Now I'm saying another 2 or 3 weeks. This particular presentation I have cobbled together from some of our other materials, so I don't have a specific copy of this presentation, I'm afraid. So, the first thing about the workshops that I have to say is that the free workshops in Victoria have actually finished, but I am going to just talk to you about them a little bit. The first set of workshops are called, the opportunities workshops that I'm really talking about today are finished in Victoria. So I just wanted to point out to you that they will be available, they are free workshops, they will be available in Sydney, Adelaide, Hobart in terms of the nearest capital cities. So if you felt that, you know, your a CEO or board member from your organisation, I just point out that they still haven't run, and so they're still available if you were in a position to travel there. And we will continue to accept this type of invitation, if that's at all helpful. The understanding workshops, which I'm going to explain to you in just a moment, we ran the free ones already. We're running another set of we've already run some FIFA service train-the-trainer sessions for service providers in Melbourne, and we will run a second set. If you were to email me very nicely on disabilityloop@afto.org.au, I might be able to squeeze you in as a freebie there, but you just make sure that, just email Disability Loop and just say, could you forward this email on to Catherine? If you wanted to try and get a place at the train-the-trainer workshops, and we'll do our best. So the train-the-trainer workshops are the nuts and bolts of the NDIS. So they're very much going into some detail, and they're for organisations that give, you know, that do other training or that give advice or give information to people with disability and families. And so they go through, how does the NDIS work? Reasonable and necessary, which interestingly has actually been the most popular workshop. I thought it might be the planning one, but it turns out reasonable and necessary. Planning and standing strong. I have my plan what now, so that's about plan implementation. Plan management explained, and is self-management for me. So, and What we found is some people have booked in for some and not all, but then what happens is they ask questions and we say, oh, that's explained all in, you know, workshop number four. So we can't necessarily get... Sorry, I'm just standing on a cord here. Sorry, Melissa. There we go. So it just means that we can't always go into the... You know, we go into a fair bit of detail on each topic. We can't necessarily do an unrelated topic because we're... only have the time available to do the one. But they're the ones, those ones I just described, they're the ones that we will be doing fee for service in Melbourne. And as I said, if you contact us because you are very keen to come to some, or contact me, we'll do our best to just quietly, just so you would need to be very discreet about the fact that we had let you in for free. The opportunities workshops, well, both sets of workshops come out of the gap analysis that we did last year, where we got the really strong feedback that quite a lot of people with disability, if not the majority, don't get their information from the internet, and in fact get information from community organisations. So it might be a disability-specific organisation, might be an advocacy organisation, might be a cultural grouping, but it's through those grassroots organisations where people meet with their peers that a lot of information is shared. And so the reason we put together the understanding group of workshops was to try and really... But those organisations have very few resources, just talking about... being in rural communities where you don't have the resources near you. So one of the things we were trying to do was create resources that were easily accessible for organisations who could then use them to give good quality information to the people they support. The opportunities workshops are directed at organisations. So this is just really looking at the sustainability of organisations and the opportunities for organisations within the NDIS environment, and talking through some of the changes for us as people that work in organisations. And that's working on the theory, which I think is relevant, that people with disability are best served if all organisations don't fall over as we manage the transition to the NDIS. And so it's making sure that we can navigate that change as organisations, as well as people with disability and families. And so the four workshops there are opportunities in the NDIS for community organisations and NDIS opportunities in detail. And that particularly looks at opportunities around becoming a registered provider of supports, and particularly around the issue of service coordination, of provider of support coordination. And that's very much... I'm going to spend about half of today talking about that. The third one is ILC readiness for community organisations, and I am going to basically read out the list that we finish at the workshop on in terms of the readiness activities that you might want to think about doing now in the lead up to the ILC, on the assumption that ILC might be of interest to you as well. And then the last one is navigating LAC and the participant pathway. And so that one very much talks about... there hasn't been a lot of discussion about local area coordination and what that means for organisations like us. I have to say that the LAC part is possibly... or the possible overlap is possibly more relevant for disability-specific organisations and information providers, even though you provide information as well. So I haven't gone into that detail today, but that's the one where we also talk about the new first plan process as well. And so certainly when it comes to questions today, assuming that we've got enough time, I'm happy to take questions on the broad range of topic and not just what I've talked about today, if that's helpful. So the highlight issues. So again, I'm in the workshops, we've got time to set some context and we've got time to go into a bit of detail, whereas today I'm sort of just going to summarise it fairly quickly. So I apologise in advance. If I'm going to try not to move too fast. I've tried to corral it, but if I do move too fast, let us know, or certainly when we get to questions, feel free to ask me any clarification questions, that's fine. So the three things that I'm going to talk about within the highlights of the training are: what is support coordination, the case for independent support coordination, and I'm going to talk about ILC readiness, and then I'll talk about the conflict of interest stuff in the last part of the presentation. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about was what is support coordination. Now, the NDIS have, when I say release some figures, certainly those of us who are allowed, you know, have access to some of the materials coming out of the CEO forums and forums like that, are aware that they have estimated that about 20% of NDIS participants will need support, will have support funding for support coordination in their plans. That's about 92,000 people. So I want you to keep that number in mind as we talk about support coordination. So support coordination is part of what is called the Assist Life Stage Transition Support Cluster in the NDIS price list. So that means if you go online and look up the NDIS price list, you need to find the heading Assist Life Stage Transition. Now, that what that's short for is the assistance in coordinating or managing life stages, transitions and supports. And this support cluster, which is a cluster of support items, so in the NDIS price guide, there are, so these are the things that appear on plans or the things that you providers invoice the NDIA for. And each support item has its own unique number. And but those supports are gathered together in a support cluster of similar activities that organisations would have are likely to deliver. So basically, they're similar support items that need the same sort of staff capabilities. So if you've got people that are capable of delivering one type of support coordination, then you've quite possibly got staff members who are capable of delivering more than one support item. So this cluster includes short and long-term supports that focus on strengthening the NDIS participants' ability to coordinate their supports and to assist them to live at home and participate in the community. So this can the broad range within this can include activities such as assisting the person with disability with budgeting, life planning, parenting training, resolving crisis situations, developing capacity and resilience in the person's network, as well as coordinating complex supports. Now, within this support cluster, there are three funded support items that are often referred to collectively as support coordination. So when we talk about support coordination in the sector, when they use the term support coordination, they're generally talking about a cluster of three support items. And these supports are provided to NDIS participants to help them get their plan going. No, I'm sorry, George just asked if there was a slide. Because I've cobbled together this from our other stuff, I didn't have enough time to put together a... I can't hear you. Oh, because it hadn't switched over. No, I haven't forgotten. It's only that I couldn't do the... I didn't have time to do the editing, sorry about that, of the existing PowerPoints that we have. So... It's about planning implementation. So what happened what we discovered in our gap analysis, and we weren't the only ones that discovered this, is that there was more than one instance where people would get into the NDIS, go through access, get their plan, had a plan, and then nothing would happen. Because the question is, what do I do next? You know, I've never had to choose a provider before. I don't know how to go about researching. I'm not sure what to do. And so, putting in more support coordination is one of the answers, and that's one of the reasons why they've now used the data they've got in the trial sites to say about 20% of people will need support coordination in their plans. So plan implementation can involve finding support providers who will fulfil the needs of an NDIS participant. It might mean introducing them to each other, the provider and the person. Providers of support coordination also help participants organise both funded and informal supports. So also help people link into networks of informal support or leverage their own existing networks or grow their own existing networks of informal support. Now, many advocacy agencies already undertake many of the activities that can be defined as support coordination, even though these activities might have been called different names. So I'll go through a few of the details. So it's worth actually thinking about whether or not your organisation has these staff competencies or has these or does these activities, even though you might call them a slightly different name, like you might call them advocacy. So, first thing to notice is the staff experience and competencies for assist life stage transition. So the expected competencies that, so when you apply, if you're an organisation, you apply to the NDIA to be registered as a provider, you'll have to show competencies for the support cluster that you apply for. So in this case, you would be applying for assist life stage transition. And to do that, you would need to show that your staff either had, if you were offering peer support, lived experience of disability or mental illness and relevant experiences and skills or training to perform this activity, or you might have people who were qualified as disability support worker, occupational therapist, social worker, might have a diploma in disability studies plus at least 2 years of experience, or a certificate 3 in disability services. But the critical thing to notice there is that the peer support and experience one is that you might already have people in your organisations who already meet those criteria. So then the question is, well, what are the activities that you might provide? So one is support connection. Now, support connection is short-term assistance that improves the ability of NDIS participants to interact with all types of disability support. So support connection increases the capacity of NDIS participants to maintain relationships with support providers and deal with any issues that come up. And I've made a mistake and put a detail in here that's about to become wrong, but the NDIS will pay providers $55.50 per hour for support connection. But of course, the new price guide's coming out on the 1st of July and that will no longer be the case. So support connection is one of these things where people, what they found in plans is typically there's a group of people that might need about 10 hours of support. You know, they just need some support to get going and then after that they're all right. So support connection's about helping people get going. So it's relatively short term. It's likely to happen at the beginning of the plan and it might have a couple of touch points along the way, but that's what that is. Then there's coordination of support. So coordination of supports is quite similar to support connection, but provides longer term assistance. So in addition to the activities that I just described, it also helps people in more complex environments. So coordination of supports might help find solutions to problems that participants face in times of crisis and help develop their resilience. So this it's a longer term thing. There might be some people that just need support connection for a longer time. And for this, at the time of writing, the NDIS was paying $90.46. And certainly it'll be interesting to ask the guys that are speaking after me about how those price points go. But I know I have already heard feedback that support connection is difficult, that $55 an hour for only a relatively short number of hours can be hard. You need a lot of people to come through your business to make that sustainable. But that support, coordination of support, which is a little bit longer term and pays at the $90.46, is possibly a line item that might be of great interest. There are also some other activities within this cluster that don't come under the support coordination umbrella, but are of interest. So one is assistance with decision-making, daily planning and budgeting. And I'm not absolutely sure, but I think that might be one of the ones where decision-making supports for decision-making, that's the line item that sort of support might come under. And that's the sort of work that advocacy workers often do. There's life transition planning and mentoring. And one of the things to think about that is that now that they're going, I don't know whether all of you know about the first plan, I'm going to take the risk that you know a little bit about the fact that first plans is a quicker process for people coming into the NDIS during the transition. But one of the things that coming in really quickly means that people get a very quick plan. So they might not have done all of their thinking about their planning yet, and they might not have thought about all the things they need to think about for a good life. One of the advantages, if you like, is that with the previous what it was like in the trial was that people would take a long time to do their planning because they had to do all this thinking. They might have needed a lot of support to imagine life differently or to think about things differently. One of the advantages of the quick and dirty plan is that it gets people in, but they might have this line item in their plan, life transition planning, and what that actually does is it enables all that planning, there's a funded item in your plan to do your planning. So the problem before was you had to do all your planning before you had a plan, so you didn't have any funding to go through your process. So one of the, you know, one of the things that I think people aren't possibly seeing about the so-called quick and dirty first plan is it actually allows you to effectively do a decent plan for your second plan. It gives you, can give you supports, but you need to say that you need it. And that might be interesting for advocacy or other agencies in terms of providing planning assistance. Then there's specialist support coordination. So this is also possibly short term, but this one focuses on complex cases that might have a higher degree of risk attached. So this might be include developing behaviour intervention plans and instructing other support workers, such as disability support workers, how best to support the NDIS participant. This one's more likely to need people with social work or, you know, some allied health sort of training, qualifications, because it's dealing with the more complex situations. And reflective of that, the unit price for that is $172.13. So the hourly rate's much higher, but it's more complex work and you're probably paying the support workers more. But that 172 hours, like, they pay for an hour of support, but of course the worker has to go back and do other work, so it's not really an hourly rate, but it's the unit price that you get paid, that would get paid. So they're the, that's the little part that I was going to talk to you about support what is support coordination? Clarify what? Oh, okay. This question's got the danger of taking us sideways. I'm going to do it really quickly and then say, talk to me separately if you want to go further. Unit price is set by the NDIA, and it's the price that the NDIA will pay for each hour of support. So that means that if you support a person with disability for an hour, they will pay you $172 for that support. But the 172, the way they've come to the number of 172 is an acknowledgement that for complex cases, probably for every hour of support that you provide directly to the person, you might have had to do other work and other coordination to support them. So there's a little bit of building in of the overhead and building in of the other things there. But that one's a particularly complex one that I don't have all the details on. But I know it's one of the things in Better Start that people got agitated about, that Better Start, you know, the people were charging out the Better Start at $120 an hour or something. And so people would get, oh, that's outrageous that the speech pathologist's getting $120 an hour. But in fact, they do the hour of support for the person, then they've got to go and write up the notes, and then they've got to coordinate with the other people, and they've got to do other work. So in fact, they might do 3 hours work for the $120, not 1 hour's work for the $120. But because you could only charge it out at an hourly rate, it ends up looking like a higher price. But we'll see how we go in question time. You can come back to that. So the thing that I wanted to talk about next is the case for independent support coordination. So again, this is what's come out of the consultation work that we did last year. But there's a series of problems in the sector. So we're having to manage all the change, same as the service providers. Our organisations are having to manage a major, major change in the environment. But the number one thing is that people in the trials, what we see is that people with disability are still not exercising their choice and control. They're not practising their choice and control. And so it means that people are often choosing more of the same. So even though they've got choice and control, we're actually not seeing it in action as much as many of us might like. And we know that barriers include experience of chronic disempowerment, which makes people much less likely to speak up, a lack of skills and experience in making decisions about what supports they need and where to source them. So if you've never been allowed to make decisions about your own life, well then, funnily enough, you actually haven't got very good at it. And so this is something that people need to practice. There's a massive lack of trusted navigators. So when people with disability and their families need information, they rely heavily on trusted navigators to get this information to help take the next step in their lives. So we would say that trusted navigators are well-informed members of the community, including organisations who have reliable, practical and independent information about the disability support systems available. And people with disability and families place a high value on the information provided by trusted navigators, as they know the information provided by them is independent. And I think this issue of independence is something, I know in the sector we've often talked about the independence of advocacy, but I think we haven't always added the part of that is the independence of information and the importance of independent information. So for us, independent information means it comes from a trusted source. It does not have a marketing purpose. It gives decision-making powers to individuals. It supports individuals to advocate for themselves. It results in better individual decisions, and it helps safeguard people with disability. And currently, there's a significant lack of trusted navigators available to provide funded support coordination and skills and capacity building activities within the sector. And the NDIS is aware that this significant gap in the market exists, and they're relying on a market demand to drive solutions. So they're hoping that organisations will just make the decision to operate in that market. And they see, frankly, that that some of the independent organisations might move into that market. So the next big problem is the conflict of interest concerns about service providers. So many service providers give people with disability and their family information and advice about services and support, both before the NDIS and in the current NDIS environment. I know in Victoria there's, I don't know, it's 86 in people are, organisations are funded just as information providers, separately to advocacy, and some of those are just disability-specific organisations. That might be the only government funding they get. Some of them might be advocacy, but some of them are service providers. There are service providers already getting information money. Now, and it's important that people understand that this information advice is likely to have a marketing purpose, meaning that service providers often have some level of conflict of interest, even if the person with disability thinks they are acting in their best interests. And this is a very common thing, that people trust their service providers, particularly trust the workers that they know, that they see a lot, and they don't always understand that the advice they're being given is the conflict of interest. And so we, in our training, you know, we talk about the buying of the lemonade. You know, if you ask the provider of the lemonade stalls at the market which one tastes the best, well, each of them are going to say, well, we taste the best because. You need to ask someone else who's tasted both lemonades to tell you which one genuinely tastes the best. But then people's tastes are different. So maybe for one person, one's better, and for another person, the other's better. But it's very important that people with disability can get information about service providers from a wide variety of places, making sure that the information is independent, accessible, and meets their needs. Then, of course, for us, there's funding insecurity. So the NDIS brings very real challenges to the sustainability of small organisations, particularly grassroots organisations that provide information support, peer support and advocacy. And we all need to adapt to the new environment in order to be sustainable. And this is because basically we've been, same as everyone else, we've been block funded too. Because we've been block funded and we're going to move to individualised funding, or particularly if you've been an information provider, maybe slightly different for advocacy, but for information provision that's been block funded, and now we have to think about individualised funding packages that are attached to individual people with disability in the form of NDIS plans, and or think about ILC grants, but once that's round out. Another challenge to us is charging fee for service. We've always prided ourselves that we don't charge people with disability and families money or the minimum that we can, because we understand that people are often find that very difficult. But of course, those or the things that we provided were never free. It's just that they were block funded and we provided them to the community for free. But now, instead of the money coming to us and we dividing for free, the money will go to participants and they will have enough money to pay. So we have to get our heads around the fact that maybe we have to provide charge a fee for a service. And this may seem contrary to the original vision and mission of many organisations, but I think it's worth having a think about it, because it may be possible that you can both charge a fee and remain true to your mission and vision, given that the environment has probably changed significantly from when your organisation was established. The other thing to be aware of is that the NDIS will fund some information and support activities within plans. So, disability support organisations, advocacy organisations, often connect people with disabilities into formal services supports and informal services and supports. It's exactly what I just described in support coordination. So if you already do these things, the answer is that now these things will be funded through plans. So that was never available before, but now it is. We need to think about the fact of what is our existing expertise. Do we in our organisations already have the expertise that I just talked about? Do we already have people with the right qualifications and the right personal experience and the right professional experience? And the last thing to think about when we're thinking about all of this is that the NDIS Act is very clear about no overlap. So one of the things that we'd all be familiar with is there's no overlap between the NDIS and the health system, for example. So if you've got a broken leg, you go and get yourself fixed in the health system. The NDIS doesn't pay for someone who's had a car accident and has a broken leg, because the NDIS is to pay for the supports that are not available elsewhere. So we all sort of know that, but in the NDIS itself, it will only pay for supports once. So if they fund a certain type of support within plans, then you won't be able to get that through the ILC. So if you provide very individualised services, then need to seriously look at becoming a registered provider, because even though you might go for an ILC grant, if the things that you do are very individualised, they may not meet the ILC criteria. And so one of the questions that came up in one of our sessions was about an organisation that provide support in schools for Tommy. And they said, well, what if we go and do a presentation to the staff about Tommy? So Tommy's a boy with a disability. And the answer is, if you give a very, very individualised talk about Tommy's very specific needs or help map out a program for Tommy, then what you're really doing is individualised support, and probably you need to be looking at, if that's what you do, you need to really seriously be looking at becoming a registered provider of supports. If, on the other hand, you go in and you talk more generally about disability, even though you might have expertise in one particular disability, so in my case, I might, you know, organisations that I used to work for might go in and talk about Down syndrome, and even though they might talk about Tommy a little bit, they might talk more about Down syndrome in terms of saying that people with Down syndrome are more likely to have low muscle tone, are more likely to have an intellectual disability, and more likely to have a learning profile that means they're likely to be a visual learner. That would still be much more general, and that's more likely to come under ILC. So one of the things as organisations that we need to do is go, what sorts of activities do we do? Are they highly personalised or are they more general? And that will help us decide whether or not we should become a service provider of individualised supports or possibly an ILC provider. And of course, it's not for me to tell you what you do, but this is one of the things that organisations might think about doing. Which takes me into the next part of what I was going to talk about, which is ILC readiness. Because one of the things to do when you're talking about becoming ILC ready is working out what you do. And one of the really tricky things for advocacy, and this goes to the sort of things that were talked about at the DANA summit earlier in the year, is it's tricky because it seems like the NDIS is deconstructing advocacy, or it's looking and going, well, this part of advocacy and this part of advocacy are going to sit in individualised plans, but this part of advocacy and this part of advocacy might sit in ILC, and this part of advocacy is still going to be funded by DSS. And so it's complicated, which is why I'm encouraging organisations, and part of the purposes of the workshop is say, start your thinking now, even if you don't start acting now, because there's quite a bit to get through. So, ILC. At the end of our workshop, we talk about readiness considerations. So we talk about these are the sorts of things that your organisation might want to think about before the grants open up, because if you haven't thought about it by the time the grants open up, then you're suddenly going to be stuck with a 4-week or a 6-week grants process and you won't have enough time to deal with all the issues. And so the sooner you start the thinking, the better. So one of the things is the ILC will not commence nationally in 2016 and 17. Every state and territory will transition to ILC a point that makes sense to them in the broader transition. That's the language that the NDIS uses. And what they mean by that is the states and territories fund all these ILC-like activities. So they fund information, they fund whatever, you know, the things that are going to come under ILC. At some point, so during the transition, at some point, probably, possibly, when there are more people in the NDIS than left in the state system, but at a point that makes sense to them, the states will say, okay, it doesn't make any more sense for us to fund these things anymore. These things should be funded by the NDIS. And it's that negotiation that happens at a bilateral agreement level, so between the state government and the federal government, not between the NDIA and the state, but between the state government and the federal government, they'll decide when that's going to happen, and then the NDIA will have to implement it. So that's why we've ended up with these weird staged things, state by state, and we actually don't know. I'm hoping by the time I finish these workshops we do, but at the moment, of course, we only know ACT. We don't know anywhere else yet. But what we do know is that will all happen before 2019. So even though we don't know the order, we know it's going to happen in the next 3 years. And so we don't want to be an ostrich and stick our head in the sand and say we don't need to worry about it yet, because we know it's coming. It's different for national organisations, but I think probably the only national organisations in the room today are HAFTO and DANA, so I might not go through some of the complexity for national organisations, but if you did want me to mention it, do ask in the questions. Again, thinking about the duplication, thinking about if what you do fits under the ILC banner or not. One of the really important things to consider if you're thinking about ILC is evidence of need. So a major in the ILC consultations, the NDIE said that it will be looking for applications that provide strong evidence of need and how the proposed activity meets that need. So this is their new focus on outcomes. But it's the collection of evidence of need that you might want to think about before you do a grant application. And evidence of need is not just about unmet need. It's also about the things you do well. So this is, now would be the time, if you're thinking about being an ILC provider and you're thinking about the activities that you do, which might meet the ILC criteria, now's the time to start collecting evidence. Start surveying the people that you support. Are you satisfied? So collect data that says that what you, on the things you do well, and also, of course, ask your members or your clients, what things don't we provide that you think we could? And that'll start telling you about the unmet need. So when you get the grant application and they say show evidence of need, you'll have something to fill out. Because if you start trying to do it 4 weeks, 4 weeks of data is not going to be enough. Activity pricing. Another thing to start thinking about is the grant funding. So now I'm talking about ILC. So before I was talking about unit price, now I'm just talking about activity pricing. Grant application fundings within the ILC will require detailed budget. But of course, a lot of organisations haven't tracked the actual cost of ILC activities because block funding has allowed things to subsidise one or the other. So for instance, when I went into Down Syndrome Victoria, one of the things we discovered, of course, was that the printed journal that we sent out 4 times a year was costing us an absolute bomb. And it was something that, but the flip side of that is when we surveyed members, they valued it very, very highly. So trying to do that, and so one of the things that ended up out of that was we changed a state-based journal into a national journal because it was crippling all the state organisations to try and produce eight different things where there was a lot of duplication. It was better to produce one and let states and territories, you know, have a page each to talk about local issues. But one of the things that was important is that what we found is that other things we did effectively subsidised that. Well, when we're going into an ILC environment, that won't be, well, it's possible, but you'll go broke in the process. So now it's making sure that when you ask for an amount of money to deliver an activity, that you actually ask for enough. So doing that thinking, because you might need supports, you might need expert financial supports to do that work. So the checklist that we talk about at the end of our workshop on ILC, so we've talked about activities. Has your organisation started to work out what ILC activities you are likely to seek funding for? Do those ILC type activities align with one or more of the activity streams? And that goes into some detail that you'd have to have read up on. Do the ILC activities address one or more or the priority investment areas? So basically it means, does the activities that you think you might get funding for meet the ILC policy and the ILC commissioning framework document? So there's two different documents you need to align with there. Do your ILC activities deliver on one or more of the ILC outcomes? And do they complement the central role of LACs? And when I talked about no duplication, the other thing to notice is that one of the things that we didn't have a lot of in trial was local area coordination. Now that they're going to roll out at local area coordination, they will not fund LAC type activities through ILC. So if your organisation does a lot of local area coordination type activities, then you want to need to really think about what's going to happen when the LACs actually start doing their job. Measurements. So the ILC, there's going to be an ILC toolkit coming. So the NDIA is in the process of developing a toolkit, which is particularly going to be emphasis on helping organisations adjust to outcomes and help people go through. So when you, if you see any workshops which are going to be run by Social Ventures Australia, you see any workshops about ILC or an ILC toolkit and you think you might go for ILC funding, I highly recommend you attend. Or if it's an online toolkit, I highly recommend that you go through the online resource. So the questions are, has your organisation started to measure outcomes for its ILC type activities? Has your organisation started mapping the needs of people with disabilities and family that you support? By that I mean, are you recording the things that you do well? Are you recording the things that people tell you they'd like to see you do or that they can't get support to do? So it's the needs, the met needs and the unmet needs. Finance and pricing. Have you started to look at the pricing of your ILC activities? Do you really know how much they cost? Do you know how much your overheads cost? So you can put an allocation of overheads into an ILC grant, but you can't cover 100% of your overheads with an ILC grant. So do you understand what your overheads are? Can your organisation demonstrate strong organisational capacity? So this is saying, if you're a $200,000 organisation, it's probably best not to go for $5 million because you haven't shown that you've got the capacity to run a project that big. You want to stage up. So it's saying, have you made sure that what you're asking for, that you're able to demonstrate that you've got the experience and expertise to deliver what you're saying you can deliver? And do you have access to grant writing training or grant writing expertise, especially expertise in writing to set criteria? Because this is one of the things we learned from the DSO project, and one of the things about a competitive grant environment, it might be that you meet everything. It might be that your project is really, really good, but still misses out because of the other priorities, you know, because it's a limited pool of fund, maybe another organisation put in something slightly better or slightly cheaper or whatever. So even though you might have a great activity, it's not a done deal that you'll get it. And so the better your grant writer, the grant writing expertise you have, that'll help. And efficiency. Have you started to talk to potential ILC activity partners? So similar organisations in other jurisdictions or member organisations about efficiency and effectiveness. So they're going to be asking about efficiency and effectiveness. So where this really comes into play is, say you're a state-based disability-specific organisation, the ILC is really only going to fund one disability-specific website, not nine. They're not going to do a national one and eight state and territory ones. So have you started to talk to your other jurisdictions about, or how might we work together? And have you started to think about who your competitors might be? Because funnily enough, the people who might be your partners might also be your competitors. And so trying to maybe differentiate what you do. So that example that I just used, maybe if you're a disability-specific organisation, maybe it would be appropriate for the national organisation to submit for a national website on the nuts and bolts of that disability. But maybe the state and territory organisations might talk about a website that's about community connections and peer support groups and other things. So maybe you can help not be a competitor with each other because you've really tailored what you do, and you can say, we all support both. So you're able to be partners in both. Or maybe you end up in a situation where whether you're competing with each other, but at least you don't do it accidentally. If you're going to compete with each other, you can do that knowingly. Or maybe you're thinking about a service provider who you've worked with quite well in the past, but maybe that service provider is going to might go for ILC funding, the same funding as you do, and you really want to make the case, well, we're for people with disability by people with disability. So there's some complex things to think about, and so it could be good for boards to think about those issues now. So finally, I'm talking about some of the conflict of interest issues. And this is informed by a conversation I had yesterday with Carolyn Wilkes. So I already gave a brief presentation at a DARU, the previous DARU sector conversation. And there are a few questions came up then. I presented at the DANA summit. And we've also done some training. And there are some similar questions that come up every time. So I went to Canberra to try and sort out whether or not we could get some answers. The good news is I got a sense of what the answers are going to be, and the good news is that clearly these issues will be resolved by the time the review is complete. The bad news is they're not landed yet. So everything I've told you so far is backed up by evidence. We've made sure that we're giving you accurate information. We're now embarking a little bit into reading of tea leaves. So I just want to be clear that some of the things I'm going to say to you are the impression I get rather than clear statements. So, I assume you all know the review timing, so the National Disability Advocacy Program review timing. One of the things that Carolyn sort of said to me a little bit off the record was she had, because she was relatively new at the time, well, I'm saying because she was relatively new, she didn't pick up that the sector did not have enough information. And so they've done more work on information delivery, and my understanding was they were about to tell the sector some more stuff, and then we went into caretaker mode. And so now we have to wait till we're out of caretaker mode. So the good news is I think there's more information coming once the election's settled and we're out of caretaker mode. I believe that submissions, I think, closed yesterday or the day before, that they've just closed submissions. I think they're accepting more, but I think that they start their deliberations from now. They fully intend to have recommendations to the minister in October, and they fully expect to be telling the sector what things are going to look like by the end of the year. Some of the things, these are my observations of the discussions. I get the sense that some reassurances are coming in terms of there's no great desire to kill off organisations and to kill off small organisations. You know, there's a great desire to not lose expertise from the sector. I was very pleased because I didn't know the team in that area at all, that I did feel that they were internally advocates for advocacy, that internally they are pro-advocacy philosophically, and I thought that was happy, that was a good thing to see.
I am Eve. I belong to the Disability Resource Centre down at Dandenong. And I know that the advocate is a very small advocate service, and she does very well. We do need NDIS, and I do know that the advocate did say that those who have been once the NDIS, she's very cautious, it's coming through in 2018, but she also has said that she feels as though many of the advocate, many of the students or the clients that she helped will miss out once the NDIS has well and truly have come through. And she's asking that question, why? And I'd probably be asking the question, why has it been taking so long to be rolled out?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing because they have to get themselves organised is part of the answer to that, in that organising for 460,000 people is a lot, and changing a system is a lot. And so they've had to put things in place, and really they're actually doing it pretty quickly when you think. So during the trial, they made about 800 access decisions per month. So that means about 800 people came into the scheme per month during the 3 years of the trial. Over the next 3 years, it'll be 12,000 people. So it's 15 times as many are going to come in. So it's been about them making sure that they can set up, that they can cope, and they barely will, with those numbers. The NDAP review itself is going to specifically look at conflict of interest issues and is specifically going to, so I was really pleased. The bad news was they weren't able to say to me where they were going to land, but they said that there was going to be discussions on this and that they were going to work really closely with the states and territories, because one of the other things that's come up is that the potential inconsistency between state and territory advocacy programs and the NDAP program in terms of what conflict of interest is or how to manage any perceived conflict of interest, actual or perceived conflict of interest. And they are going to work so that by the time they talk to all of you, us, you, in later in the year, that will have been resolved. And so I was really happy that that was clearly on the agenda. Clearly one of the things they're thinking about, but it hasn't landed, is that they may regard support coordination as a special category of provider. Now, my discussions with the NDIA so far have been that the NDIA is not interested in having special categories of support. The NDIA just has its price list, that's that. You're either a provider or you're not a provider. But that doesn't stop DSS saying within the NDAP program, well, within the NDAP program, you're not eligible for the NDAP program if you're a registered provider, except if you provide coordination of supports. So it's clear that they are looking to possibly put support coordination in a special category when it comes to managing conflict of interest. No. I'm talking about being eligible for the NDAP program. So if you're going to get funding through the National Disability Advocacy Program. Yes. So I'm not talking about the conflict of interest of server providers. That's a separate issue which is being resolved. But I'm talking specifically, if you are currently funded by the NDAP program,
yes,
then the question is, to be eligible, if you're a service provider, can you be a service provider and eligible for NDAP? Okay. And it's the answer historically, theoretically, has been no, except for I know that boundary has been blurred in a couple of specific cases. So they're looking to unblur that boundary. They're looking to say, this is the rule. To be eligible for NDAP, then you can't be, well, they haven't said this yet, you can't be a service provider. But what, this is the reading of the tea leaves, where I think they're heading is you can't be a registered provider to be an NDAP provider, except if you provide coordination of supports. We will, you can, that's like a special category. But they haven't said that, they're considering that.
The other things that you mentioned.
The other things that I mentioned, well, I think this will be, that'll be part of the discussion.
Advocacy-like activities.
That'll be part of the discussion. So one of the things that I didn't ask, actually, and I realise now that I've come away, is that the way that the NDIS approves providers is through a support cluster. So what happens is that you apply and you get approved for a support cluster. So you don't get approved to supply one support item. You support provide a cluster.
Mm.
And what we call support coordination is three items within a cluster of, I'm not sure how many items are in there, 6 or 7 or 8 items. So I would think, so this is me, I would think that if they were going to approve support coordination, they'd have to say they'd approve that whole assist, whatever, I always forget what it's called, the one, the cluster that I said, the assist life stage transition cluster. But that's not, that's why there's clearly got to be discussions between now and then. And if you've got an opinion on that, I would highly recommend that you're right to end up.
It's called the assist?
The assist life transition cluster.
And that's the one that covers advocacy like.
And it has those things that I just talked about, decision supports, transition planning supports, and support coordination. Carol's probably got better advice than me.
Actually, maybe, maybe not, but I think there is another category that maybe Paul can help me. But certainly it's not just assist life transition. There's another one, that budgetary, all of that stuff.
Oh, sorry, the plan management one.
No, not only plan management. Plan management comes under assist life transition, but there's another. Another cluster.
Yeah, there are. That's the thing. So
the peer,
I think
the peer support and things like that.
Yeah. So what I think is that clearly they've got to sort that out. Like they've got to sort it out practically, so that organisations can. But it also, that would be the question. They would have to draw a line somewhere. And so the question is, do they draw the line at life assist transition, or do they say you can supply these two clusters? So this is the unknown. And the other thing that they're... that's all right.
For Victoria and non-NDAP funded,
yep.
We can do what we like.
And I think one of the things that's going to happen now as part of this NDAP review is there is negotiations happening with the state and territories, and they're going to try and bring that into some sort of consistency.
I just, my question is, if disabled persons organisations aren't doing it and the service providers are conflicted,
exactly.
Then who's left? Then there's no one left.
That's the case. That's the case for independent support coordination. There's a question over there in a second. But that's exactly the case. If we don't do it, if independent organisations don't do it, then people with disability won't be able to access it unless new organisations...
Are providers allowed to do it?
Sorry, say that again.
Are providers allowed to do it?
Providers are allowed to provide support coordination,
well, that's
but
all
they...
kinds of wrong.
They're supposed to have... they're supposed to have processes in place, but what we all know, what advocacy agencies know, what we at AFTO know through the gap analysis is that in practice that's not true. And so, but one of the problems is there are very few organisations for the NDIA to point at to go, here's some independent ones. So the thing is, from the NDIA's point of view, they're really, I'm reading tea leaves again here just so we understand that I'm talking about what I've picked up, but I get very, very strong vibes from the NDIA. They're very keen for advocacy and information organisations to be providers of independent support coordination. They would like to see a much bigger well of independence there available to people with disability.
I'm hearing that.
But now we've got to bump that up against an advocacy program and say, well, the organisation's best place to do that are advocacy agencies and independent information providers. But for advocacy, you don't want to lose your NDAP funding because you've become, well, you might be happy to do that, but you don't want to risk your NDAP funding because you're doing this other thing. Yes. There's another question over here.
I'm sitting here knowing several people who are at or near retirement after 30 or 40 years working in advocacy organisations who have all the skills to set themselves up as individual providers or for the three of them to get together and do so. We could see some really useful things for people out of disability come from people with a lived experience and a worked experience and an understanding of where both the service providers and small advocacy agencies fail out of this. There could be some interesting things happen.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful opportunity, and certainly if I lose my job in the next little while, I know what I'll be thinking about doing. But I think there's some really good opportunities there to do things a bit differently if we want to.
There are many people who are representing the advocates around here who know what they're saying and know what they're doing.
That's right.
And even if they can help out with advocates that wants to set up an organisation, they can be there helping them. As you know, it's probably learning some more experiences from them, and that would be beneficial.
That's right. And so one of the things that I know is that they're talking about too, is saying, if advocacy agencies, if some advocacy agencies would like to become providers, and that becomes, and then within the end-up guidelines, that's okay, then it's important that there's some agencies that don't as well. So that way, for people with a disability, they've still got choice. So you can go to an advocacy agency who doesn't do any support coordination, or you can go to an agency that does. So. And the other thing, Mary's got a question. Oh, Christian's got a question. Is that just the final thing I was going to say just on that is, it seems unlikely at this stage that they will regard ILC as a conflict of interest at this stage. So at the moment, it looks like if you apply for an ILC, if you are successful in being an ILC provider, that's relatively unlikely to be a conflict of interest. But one of the things that I just did want to say, because I think we're moving into the question time now, I just really want to say strongly about starting thinking, but for advocacy organisations specifically, as opposed to information organisations, there's clearly a whole lot of things that are going to land before the end of the year in terms of the NDAP review. And so, I don't know, I came away thinking if I was the CEO of an advocacy organisation, I'd be having a whole lot of board discussions, and I'd be doing a whole lot of thinking, and I'd start some measuring, but I maybe wouldn't take any action until the NDAP review's finished. Maybe. I don't know. Christian.
The question is about paying for the service that we use. Basically, people who are receiving the NDIS, of course, will be able to pay for the service that they need. But what happens to people who are not receiving the NDIS, and they still need support, but they cannot afford to pay for it?
Yeah, so there's a couple of... So it means that you need to have multiple sources of income. So what is intended once the NDIS is rolled out fully is there's a commitment by government that advocacy is going to be funded independently of the NDIS. So there's an absolute commitment that the NDAP program is going to continue, and that will continue to be funded for individualised advocacy. So that means that any person who needs an advocacy support can get it, whether or not they're an NDIS participant. So you can still get advocacy support. The other thing is that once the LACs, once local area coordination is rolled out, that one way of accessing support, not proper advocacy, but one way of maybe even linking with advocacy, will be via LACs, because any person with disability can get support from an LAC. You don't have to be an NDIS participant. But thirdly, to have specific individualised support, to get specific support with decision support or specific support in linking you with service providers, that's the bit that will be paid for within a package. So an advocacy agency can still just be NDAP funded and provide advocacy like we always have. It can work with our local area coordinators to make sure that the local area coordinators know that they exist and can refer people to them. But if you want to give individualised support around plan implementation, then you have to be a registered provider. So it's really, in many ways it's an additional thing, but the fact is that agencies often provide a lot of individualised support, and so what will happen in the NDIS is that those people might disappear from advocacy because they're in support coordination, maybe. So the idea is not to cut out the people who are not participants. The idea is that they will still have access to advocacy. I think I'm down to the last few questions now, so I finish on time.
Thanks, Catherine. Just you mentioned that DSS said that they thought some... So if this whole thing plays out as you're thinking, that some advocacy organisations then may register to do support coordination, but that they would... The implication is they will somehow make sure that some advocacy organisations remain pure advocacy or something like that, so that there's choice. Now, I've had informal conversations with them about the same thing, and it makes no sense to me. It's completely naive and bizarre that how could a funding program say, well, you lot of advocacy organisations, you can go and find other funding where you can, and we'll make this accessible to you, but this lot here, you have to stay entirely in your black and white advocacy box and you can't do other things. But there's no possible way I can see they can do that.
No, I came away sort of thinking afterwards, they have to make it practicable. Like, it has to be organised. You need to be able to do it. So even this thing about, oh, maybe we'll allow support coordination, really they have to allow the cluster, you know. And in what you're saying there is, I think what they meant was they won't push people in either direction. I think maybe what they're saying is it'll be okay to be a provider of organ... If they make that decision, it'll be okay to do support coordination. They'll probably require... There'll be some requirements about how you manage that conflict of interest, and I'm assuming Carol might be able to shed some light on that, but I think one of the things that they'll do is, if you do it, then these are the rules, and it will be okay for agencies to choose not to and to choose to. I don't know how they do that by quotas or something, because I think at the end the agencies are free to make up their own minds, or should be free to make up their own minds. So that's a bit unclear. And I think that this is what's got to be nutted out between now and the implementation is the practicalities of how something like that would work. And so that's why, to be fair to them, that's why it's difficult. They don't really want us coming out and saying, oh, they're thinking about this and they're thinking about that, because it's much easier to just go, this is how it's going to work. So I don't know whether I'm doing you a favour or a disservice to say the good news is that they're thinking about these different things. But, of course, we've got to wait to see where exactly it lands.
Catherine, is that on?
Is that on?
I feel like you haven't answered what your topic was. So you were here to talk about managing conflicts of interest, and you haven't said a word about how we need to manage conflicts of interest. So you tell us about what kind of areas under the... sorry, I didn't mean to... I'm just being honest about what I've heard. You were going to... you talked about how we can possibly address some of the NDIS services, so what we might want to look at under the ILC and also under support coordination. But you've said nothing about how we, as advocacy orgs, are going to manage conflicts of interest. So...
Oh, well, I'm sorry. That's probably more of a miscommunication, in that what I said I was going to present on was the material from our workshops, which does not address the...
I just said so on your
the, well...
It's weird, that's all.
Well, that's all right. That's just... That's... The issue is that we wanted to talk about conflict of interest, which we've done. But no, you're right, because I can't talk to you about how to manage them. In fact, I think that you'll find that the last session might address that a bit better. But that's just apologies for the communication between me and Melissa. Basically, I can only talk to you about the things that are in the workshops at this stage.
You.
I also know, from what I've seen, that the packages are on a slower conveyor belt Are those packages going to be quicker? Because there are so many people who are have a disability are well and truly dependent on those packages, and they have been hearing complaints about them being slowly delivered to them. Are they going to be a
Well, that's the whole thing. They've got to go from 800 to 12,000 a month, so they've got to get a lot quicker. So yes.
Thank you.
But that's the plan. We'll see how it goes. Think we're done?
Great. Are there any other questions for Catherine? None at all? Okay. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. It was a great presentation. I think it was extremely worthwhile listening to it. So we'll break now for afternoon tea, and if we could get back here seated by 3 o'clock, that would be fantastic. Thank you.